Hello and welcome to Playback Daily for Wednesday, the 19th of February. I'm Louise Herity and here's some of what's coming up.
They don't drink heavily, like, and they don't socialise like that either. They are outside all the time. They drink smoothies. They run everywhere. They cycle everywhere. They love their rules, which is a big problem for Irish
right.
people.
Pictures still will be abused and people still will take them.
Mm-hmm.
And I think we just have to be very mindful. You know, I always think, if I put that picture out there, it's out there forever. Is that something that's going to come back and they might not like it in years to come, or they might say, why did you do that?
I looked at the draw and I'll be honest, I just kind of started laughing, and I texted my wife and I was like, did you see the draw? And she just said, it's brilliant. These are the fellas you need to be playing. Just go out and beat him and just do your best.
Sharing images or videos of your children online, also known as sharenting, was up for discussion on Today with Claire Byrne. To chat about things like safety and privacy concerns, the host was joined by Mary McCarthy, columnist with the Irish Independent, and Siobhan O'Neill White from mams.ie.
Mary, I might start with you. What's your own take on sharing images or videos of your children, on sharenting?
Morning, Claire. Yes, I'll be honest, Claire, I don't do it anymore. I used to do it, and I tell you, I'm really tempted because, for two reasons. First, for professional clout, because you do get more engagement, Claire, when you use your kids, right? For example, after the Dublin riots, I brought my kids into town to show that I didn't think there was any danger. And I took a picture of them on the Halfpenny Bridge. I got loads, like that posted really well. Usually my post, like, I'll be lucky to get 3 or 4 likes, you know. And if that was just me scowling at the camera into the, you know, on the Halfpenny Bridge, I wouldn't have gotten any likes. So it does, I can see why people do it, because you do definitely get more engagement. So that's why I'm tempted. And then on a personal reason, I'm proud of my kids. Like, Claire, I honestly feel they're my biggest achievement. So I want to get them out there, you know. I don't do it now because my kids hate it, right? They really, really give out about it. They get really annoyed. So that's the last pic I put on Twitter, though. I think that was last year. And the last time I had them in the newspaper article was actually just during COVID, because it was for article for video games. And they actually demanded that I give them the newspaper fee, because they were like, Mammy, we're not doing it again. We don't want our picture in the paper. And the reason they didn't like it was because my eldest was beginning to Google online and he could see, and his friends were slagging him. So I see how people, I understand why people do it, but I think people don't think enough about what their kids are going to think of them later on.
Yeah, because when they get older, they get very clued in, as yours are now, and they decide, you know, in your case, that they don't like it. Siobhan, I know you use social media for your website, mams.ie. I'm just having a look at it here. You ask your children, do you, if they want to be in the post? Is that how it works in your house?
Yeah, I do. So, I mean, I've been doing this since 2009. So I was made redundant and I wanted a job that I could work around the kids, you know, so this suited us and our family dynamic. But, you know, if we were going off and doing a review, say in a hotel or something like that, I would speak to the kids about it and ask them, is it okay? We might do, you know, we might do a little video, or we might do some pictures. And sometimes they say yes and sometimes they'd say no. And that's absolutely fine. You know, it's not their job to do that kind of thing. Now, my girls are great. They generally don't mind. They'll hop into certain videos and we'll have a little bit of a skit. My son doesn't really like it, so he's not really in them. And I've had people say to me, oh God, you wouldn't even know you had a son. And I say, yeah, but I respect his privacy. If he doesn't want to be, you know, in videos or in pictures or something like that, I absolutely respect his choice, and that's absolutely fine. Mm-hmm. I think we, as my family has a WhatsApp group, and we share most of the things in that privately. When Facebook was big back in the day, we did share stuff, but I would have my own page private, and most of my family would as well. I think a lot of people don't realize that you should probably set your page to private.
Yeah, you're conscious of it.
Look at your settings, because people will take your children's images and use them for other purposes. And I was saying to your researcher earlier, my daughter, Robin, she donated 12 inches of her hair to the Rapunzel Foundation, which is for children with cancer and alopecia, and they make them wigs. And we did, you know, she did this thing. And I said, you know, is it okay if we do a little blog about this? And we weren't getting paid for it or anything. We just thought it was a really nice thing to do. We know someone who has alopecia and how, you know, much that can affect your life. And we put up a little picture with the salon and stuff like that, and it encouraged other people's children to go and do the same thing. So that was a really nice thing to do. However, somebody on Instagram took her picture, that picture with her donating her hair, and used it for a completely different purpose. So I had to report that to Instagram, contact them, tell them they hadn't, you know, they did not have my permission to use that picture. So it was taken down. So even when I'm careful about what I share and I'm careful about my settings, pictures still will be abused and people still will take them. Mm-hmm. And I think we just have to be very mindful. You know, I always think, if I put that picture out there, it's out there forever. Is that something that's going to come back and they might not like it in years to come, or they might say, why did you do that? So I think about it in that respect.
Yeah, I mean, I have this in my head that, you know, you can share images of your children now when they're young, but don't forget that you'll probably have a 17-year-old who's much taller than you asking you, you know, with a very angry face, why you decided that it was okay to share that picture. And that probably is going to happen, isn't it?
It will happen.
I'm there,
I have teenagers now. Yeah, I have teenagers, and that's why I completely respect if they don't want to be involved with something. That's absolutely their right, and that's their choice. And you know, if I'm going off to do something and the kids don't want to get involved, maybe my mom or sister will come along with me, and we'll do something. So I will always work around the kids, but I always think, in 10 years' time or whatever, you know, is that something that they're not going to be happy about? And I make loads of photo albums in our house. I do loads of photos. So at Christmas time, when all the family get together, I make the kids get into pictures for that. And we make up a family calendar every year, and they're not allowed to get out of that one.
Right.
But that's not to be shared on social media. Yeah, that's
different.
For our own family.
Mary, you wanted to come in there. What did you want to say?
Oh, no, I just said, Claire, I am that mother looking up at my son, and he's saying, why is this picture online, you know? So, like, I do think, Siobhan, you sound like you have kind of, you've talked to them enough, so you've got their opinions. Like, what I find really annoying is the people who put pictures of their kids up and they have the emojis over their eyes. You know, have you seen that are like a heart over their face? Like Mark Zuckerberg does that with his three daughters. And at least, Siobhan, like, you own it, you put it up and you've talked to your kids.
Yeah.
Maybe they won't mind. It sounds like you've done your due diligence. I didn't do my due diligence. I just went ahead. And now, Claire, I am that, you know, I do have my son. And he uses it to blackmail me. He say, well, you put a picture up of me, you didn't actually ask me. So can I have €20 to go out on Friday? So, I mean, I just can't do it anymore because also my partner, he was also really annoyed. So just to keep the peace, I don't do it. And I kind of do see friends with younger kids, and I feel like saying to them, but you see, you don't want to be judgy over anyone, you know. But I mean, never mind the online predators, and there are online predators, right? But it's the respecting the privacy and your relationship with your kids. Like, that's the main thing, you know.
And Siobhan, I'm conscious that there's a baby there who might need you more than we do. So if you have to run, just go, right? We understand.
Yeah.
I just have a message here.
There wasn't a peep. And then the minute I start chatting, he just starts chatting.
That's always the way, because you're supposed to be, in his mind, only talking to him. This listener says, what on earth is wrong with parents having to share everything, their poor children? And I did ask Mary that in the first of all, and she gave us some really good reasons why you would want to do this, because you're proud of your children, because you're going to get more interaction with people if you put them on social media than you would if it was just you. But can you answer that, Siobhan, for that listener? Why do people feel they have to share everything?
Because we're in a share culture. I mean, if you go out now, I mean, I know if I go out with my younger sister, we do the boomerang with the drinks and we do the selfies and all this kind of stuff. If I go out with my friends in our 40s, we don't do any of that. It's generational. I just think this generation coming up, it's like, if it didn't happen, if it's not recorded for social media, if it's not for the gram, it didn't happen. Where, like, when I went to Taylor Swift, I listened to Taylor Swift. I didn't record Taylor Swift. And I was looking at people recording, and I just thought, they're missing it. They're missing the gig.
Yeah.
You're missing your life. And if you're taking 20 pictures of your baby to get the perfect picture. You're missing that time with your baby. Take a couple. If they're not great, so what?
Well, listen,
it's fine, but I
don't
think
want
more
you
about
to
living in the moment.
That was Siobhan O'Neill White from mams.ie and Mary McCarthy, columnist with the Irish Independent, on Today with Claire Byrne. Yesterday morning, we heard that Irish social care worker and amateur darts player Michael Flynn pulled off the unthinkable when he beat three-time world champion Michael van Gerwen in a major darts tournament in the Netherlands. The Limerick man was called up at the last minute to play in the Players' Championship 3 tournament after a series of withdrawals. And he spoke to Maggie Doyle on Morning Ireland.
But he's found time to speak to us, Michael Flynn. Congratulations. Hi, and thanks very much for joining us this morning. Tell us all about this very last minute call up you got when you first heard you were off to the Netherlands.
Yeah, basically, I was sitting at home feeding my daughter at about 11:30, and my phone rang, and it was my manager, Greg. He said, you're after getting called into the Pro Tour. What are the chances you can get to the Netherlands and you're playing tomorrow? So I was like, God, it was hectic from there then.
So what did you do?
Basically, I...
You put the baby down, presumably.
Yeah, she was in her high chair, so it wasn't too bad. So my wife took over. So basically, I was on the phone for about 20 minutes. And with Greg, we were looking up flights, trying to see was it possible to make Dublin for a flight, because there's none out of Shannon that would have suited. So we found a flight at like 10 to 6, whatever. So we headed for that. So packed the bags and got on the road as soon as I could.
And when did you find out who you were going to be playing?
About an hour beforehand, the draw is done about an hour before you play. So, yeah, about
okay.
an hour.
Okay, and for those, and a lot of people have become interested in darts recently. We'll get onto that in a moment. But for those who don't know who Michael van Gerwen is, just tell us.
Yeah, so Mike van Gerwen's three-time world champion. He's considered one of the greatest players ever, if not the best of all time. He played in the World Championship final just there Christmas and got beaten in the final by Luke Littler. So he's a big deal.
Yeah, and we know the name Luke Littler as well. But when you get an hour beforehand then the notice that you're going to be playing him, how do you feel?
I looked at the draw and I'll be honest, I just kind of started laughing. And I texted my wife and I was like, did you see the draw? And she just said, it's brilliant. These are the fellas you need to be playing. Just go out and beat him and just do your best.
Fair play to her. Well, that was good advice. And you did your best. Tell us about the match.
So the match, so I started pretty strong. I took the first leg, which was would help you settle in. And then it was kind of tit for tat for about three or four legs. And I got a break then. And I ended up leading 5-2, I believe. And he started to come back at me then. But I knew if it got down to the last leg, we'll say the shootout, that I knew I had the throw because I had won the bull. So I knew I was throwing first and that's why I had the advantage. So I was just kind of trying to tell myself, don't panic, that you have the advantage the whole way through the game. Just don't give it up.
And you didn't give it up. Now, not only were you playing Michael van Gerwen on home turf, like he lives just down the road. He's a local man.
Yeah, that's the thing. I only found that out when I was over that he's only a few minutes down the road or something like that. So I guess the pressure might have been on him. Maybe he felt more pressure or whatever, that he was at home and he really wanted to win when he was at home. I don't know, but whatever happened, it worked out well for me anyway.
Well, look, you lost the following match, Michael, which is disappointing. Yeah. But the win must have given you great confidence. Where do you go from here in your dart career?
100%. The confidence to know that I can compete with the best is a huge confidence. So coming up for me, I have a couple of things coming up. I have the All-Irelands next weekend. I'll try and become an All-Ireland singles champion in that and hopefully win the team event with Limerick and become All-Ireland champions of the team. And after that, I head to Germany, to Hildesheim in Germany in Paddy's weekend to compete in the Challenge Tour, which would be my own grade tournament, and hopefully try and get the results from that, which will put me back on the Pro Tour with the professionals during the year.
I mentioned at the beginning you're a social care worker, Michael, so you're busy as well. You had to get somebody to cover your shift, I understand, to go off and play in this competition.
Yeah, I spoke to my manager. She was so nice about it. Like, she understood what was after happening, and she was able to give me the time off to be able to do this. And the lads at work just kind of filled in for me and got my jobs done and whatever had to be done around.
Oh, go on, give them a shout out. You have to give them a shout out now to thank them.
Just a big shout out to everyone in Lansdale, in Castletry, and thanks for all the support.
I have a feeling that at the All-Ireland Single Championships next week, that whoever gets drawn with you will be feeling a little bit nervous. Michael, I know you've got a good... What's your darts name?
It's the Flying Flynn.
Oh, the Flying Flynn. That's a great one. Yeah. Thank you so much for joining us. Congratulations, and we wish you the best in the rest of your career as well.
Limerick social care worker and amateur darts player Michael Flynn chatting to Maggie Doyle on Morning Ireland. You don't need me to tell you, but Dublin and Galway have some of the most congested roads in Europe. That's according to transport analytic company INRIX. And Brian O'Connell was looking at the issue of congestion across Irish cities. And he had this report on Today with Claire Byrne.
Morning, Claire.
Good morning to you. The report is fairly damning, isn't it?
Well, if you look across Europe, London had the most congested roads last year, 101 hours of delays per driver, and then Paris, 97 hours. Dublin ranked the 15th most congested city in the world. And as you said, in Irish terms, then Galway and then Cork would be next most congested. I suppose anyone listening who regularly commutes in those cities, particularly at rush hour, you don't really need a report to tell you traffic issues can be very significant. There is a sense now that transport projects are high on the agenda for this government. The long-awaited upgrade between Cork and Limerick, for example, plans to advance the metro, as we know, in Dublin, bus connects, all of those. But for people who are having to navigate the current traffic levels, they won't really impact your day-to-day life in the short term. Now, one person I spoke to, Peter Coyne, lives in Galway, Claire. Traffic has gotten so bad, he said his daughter is unable to take part in many after-school activities because the congestion means it could take up to 2 hours to collect her the closer it gets to rush hour, so she has to get the bus home just after school. He details some of his thoughts on the traffic in Galway and why he stopped dropping and collecting his children from school.
We had to stop driving them in, you know, at a certain point. It was just too difficult. And when they were old enough to get the bus, they got the bus. And there's a bus lane, thank God. So it really takes maybe 5 minutes or 10 minutes to get them to school now. Our older girl is in a different situation. She's in school across the city as the crow flies, maybe 7 or 8 kilometres. She can't really do after school activities because if she does, then we can't go and collect her because we can't get across the city and back. It would take an hour to get there and an hour to get back. So that's 2 hours out of our day just to pick her up. So it is limiting her. When you live in Galway, you figure out ways of avoiding the traffic. You avoid certain times of the day. I think it's getting worse and worse and worse. This needs to be studied. Who is travelling into the city at rush hour in the morning? We need to have a deeper understanding of why there's so much traffic. You build a ring road, then you have housing development along that ring road. Then they buy cars, that ring road is full, then you need another ring road around the ring road. Well, the issue with Galway is you're only ever going to have one bypass because Loch Corrib will prevent you from building any other road. So we've only got one road to build. Imagine Dublin without the M50. Imagine if you wanted to go from the north side of Dublin to the south side of Dublin and you had to drive through up O'Connell Street to do that. That's kind of what it's like.
So that's Peter Coyne in Galway, and that ring road, as we know, is being reassessed by Onboard Planola this year. We'll get to the issues in Dublin because I wanted to give a sense, Claire, of what the congestion is like here in Cork. Now, I turned on my recorder. I documented a trip from about 8:30 onwards, leaving Blarney, heading towards Clonroe, Kerrypike, into the Bishopstown area, suburb in Cork, and then on into the city centre. So this is just a snapshot of how I got on. It's just now in the village of Blarney, and straight away we've hit our first traffic jam. There's two buses here and they are pretty much in traffic. Cars are moving quite slowly. There's a T-junction here. I've now left Clonroe. It's 8:41 a.m. and I'm on the R579. About 8 kilometres, 9 kilometres from Ballincollig, about 12 kilometres from Cork city centre. Just gone past Kerrypike. It's 8:50 a.m. and now I'm being met with the city centre traffic, which is backed up on the R579 here. Congestion is pretty much chock-a-block here. In front of us, there's a large truck. From here on in, it's anybody's guess how long it'll take to get into the city centre. This is a Bishopstown area. It's a very desirable area to live for families, as well as obviously a popular area with students. A large student complex on my left-hand side here.
just passing the CUH now. Quite a large build-up of traffic trying to access the CUH at the moment. Just coming up to 10 minutes past 9 and I'm accessing the Wilton roundabout. And I won't be going too far here because straight away I am into a large congestion of traffic on the Wilton Road here. Traffic is backed up right from the Wilton Road here for about a kilometre and a half, I would think. There's a bus lane on the left-hand side here, but a number of cars are using that bus lane. In the past 4 minutes, I've really only moved about 200 yards. It is now 10 past nine. The bus has got its hazard lights on, it's stopped. Its traffic lights up ahead are green, but nobody is moving. Now they've just turned red, and this line of traffic hasn't moved. It's completely stationary. We are now 9:15 a.m. People getting really frustrated here. Lots of beeping of the horns. Red lights again up ahead. So the lights have changed maybe 4 times since I've been quite close to them, and I haven't been able to get through them yet. It is 9:25 a.m. Almost an hour since I left Blarney, and I have arrived in Cork city centre. So that just gives you an idea of the kind of traffic congestion on a typical morning in the city centre.
All right, stuck in the car for about an hour there. That's a snapshot of Cork. So, Brian, Dublin, as we know, is one of the most congested cities in Europe, and the congestion is impacting businesses.
We have a cost on it in the greater Dublin area. Congestion estimated to cost just under 340 million in 2022. That's likely to rise to about 1.5 billion by 2040. And then nationally, congestion is projected to cost 2 billion by 2040. There has been some debate around congestion charges. We know these were introduced in London probably about 20 years ago. London remains one of the most congested cities in Europe, but there's some evidence that charges had an initial impact when they were introduced, but then the congestion kind of crept back up. I spoke to Richard Guiney, CEO of We Are Dublin Town, about the issues, Claire, congestion is posing for businesses in the capital.
We obviously do want to see the massive increase in public transport. I think we're paying an enormous price for not having built an underground system in Dublin. If you take it, the proposal for the metro will carry 20,000 passengers per direction per hour. A bus, like even the bus connects, is about 3,500. So it'll give you kind of an idea of the differential there. I get very frustrated that it takes for so long. You know, we had very good plans in 2010 for the Dart Underground and the Metro. Like, we all understand that the financial crisis happened. They didn't go ahead. But I'll never understand why that couldn't have been done as soon as the Troika were out the door. That in 2013 we weren't dusting down those plans and just implementing them. But we can't afford not to invest in those kind of large public transport plans. We can't rely on vehicular movement in the long term, but I do think we also need to do a lot of work on shared last mile delivery, so delivery hubs outside the city, and then for the smaller businesses in particular.
One of the measures proposed and in operation in some cities is congestion charges. Where do you stand on that?
I'm not a big fan. I think the technology obviously has been around for quite some time, and I do think that basically, a congestion charge would add to the cost of operating a business in Dublin city centre. Basically, every time you need a service, your costs are going to be higher. And I think that would be just enough to persuade people to close their city centre businesses and move to out-of-town locations. I actually think it would be a counterproductive move in Dublin. And if you look at the UK, yes, London has one, but Leeds, Liverpool, Manchester, etc. haven't. It's old technology, and I think we need to be a bit cleverer there.
That's Richard Guiney there. Messages on this coming in. This one from Galway. I live an hour south of Galway. If I need to travel in there, I drive to Oranmore. I get the train, which takes less than 10 minutes. What amazes this listener is the number of people that they know who would never do this. They drive the whole way into the city. Another one, traffic congestion, and there's a push to get people back to the workplace. It's ridiculous. Now, we're going to talk in a moment, Brian, about what's planned around transport in the programme for government. But I know you've spoken to one expert in this area, and it seems, unfortunately, there are no quick fixes.
Well, there is a renewed focus on projects in the programme for government around transport, which I'll come to. But as you said, what's needed really are medium to long-term plans to address congestion, many of them related to public transport options. Now, Beatrice Martinez-Pastor is an assistant professor at the School of Civil Engineering in UCD. She gave me her take on what we need to do here to address congestion, particularly in Dublin.
Dublin was the third most congested city at the European level and the 15th more congested city at the world level. So we know that the congestion is an issue that we need to tackle. I don't think that there is a single solution that can fix the problem. So we need to prepare a range of policies, a range of new infrastructure to try to provide a good balanced solution for the different users that we can see on the network. One of the things that is particularly different in Dublin when we compare it with other European cities is the how we distribute the users among the different travel modes. So Dublin is very reliant on the road-based transport. Six out of 10 journeys are done by private cars. Around maybe one out of 10 are done by bus. And then less than 0.5 out of 10 trips are done in the DART, the LUAS. So we are missing probably like additional infrastructure. I know that now the Metro Link project is going ahead. We are expecting an increase on population over the coming decades. And also probably we will see, or we have been seeing, an increment on the economic activity and economic growth. So we know that the congestion is going to be an issue that we are going to see more and more in the future years. The main problem is that when we are planning with transport-related infrastructures, it is very difficult to plan in a short amount of time. So if we want to produce new infrastructure, this has to be done in a medium to long term. So if we want to be ready for what's going to happen in 5, 10, 20 years, we need to start thinking about those issues now. So everything that relates to the creation of new infrastructure that provide a relief on the congestion on the system, it has to be done. So we need to provide a wide range of solutions. I think that it's important that we improve in all these aspects.
Now, there is, as you said, a renewed commitment to road infrastructure in the programme for government, as well as improving public transport.
Well, in the past week or so, government announced an investment programme of over 700 million for regional and local roads this year. That represents an increase of over 8% in funding for road and safety improvements on the regional and local road network. In the programme for government, if you look at transport, there is a plan to progress all key public transport infrastructure in the National Development Plan and consider new public transport projects in a review of the NDP, the National Development Plan, as well. There was a strategy around congestion, Claire, launched last year. I had a look at that. It sought to give really a strategic framework to local authorities who might want to develop ways of easing congestion. But there really wasn't any one single big ticket item in that strategy that alone would ease traffic issues, I'm afraid.
Brian O'Connell reporting on Today with Claire Byrne. Yesterday on Liveline, Joe Duffy paid tribute to the late Irish neuroscientist Eleanor Maguire, who died recently. And today we heard about more of her remarkable achievements.
And one of the people who knew Eleanor was Teresa Bourke. Teresa is retired full professor and chair of psychology at DCU. Eleanor, Teresa, how did you know Eleanor?
Well, first of all, good afternoon, Joe. I got to know Eleanor initially. She was an undergraduate student of mine when she was studying for her BA in psychology in UCD.
Okay.
And then, I suppose more than anything else, I had the remarkable honour of supervising her PhD. After she completed her degree, she moved to Swansea, did a one-year taught master's programme, and then came back and undertook her PhD studies while working at Beaumont Hospital. So I was her supervisor.
And even at that stage, Teresa, was Eleanor interested in memory and that whole area which she seemed to specialise in subsequently?
Well, Eleanor has conducted a number of interviews over the years, mainly because she was so famous within the neuroscience community.
Yeah.
And Eleanor was very open about the fact that it took her some time to establish precisely what aspect of psychology she was particularly interested in. And my first year in UCD on staff, I was teaching a final year course in neuropsychology. It was still very much in its infancy in Ireland at that time. Eleanor became fascinated with neuropsychology in particular, which is why she then moved to Swansea to take a master's degree. We didn't have one a similar type course in Ireland at the time. And she came back then to work in Beaumont Hospital, where there was a fledgling surgical program for individuals with intractable epilepsy. So Eleanor was working along with the epilepsy surgery team. And one of the things we knew was that many of these patients suffered some degree of memory difficulty as a result of their epilepsy. So Eleanor's interest was in memory effectively from the get-go.
And she was very, very keen on research. And she was, you say she was a very good researcher. She knew...
Eleanor was an exceptional researcher.
Okay.
I think it was characterized by the fact that she was willing to ask interesting questions about real-world aspects of, you know, human memory, for example. So she wasn't particularly interested in just carrying out laboratory-based studies.
Okay.
She wanted to understand the impact of difficulties with memory on individuals as, you know, they worked their way around in the world. Even her PhD itself was actually on the topic of real-world spatial memory following temporal lobe surgery in humans. So she wanted her research to address questions that were of direct relevance to individuals with memory problems. And that was obvious right from the beginning.
And tell us, Therese, about Eleanor getting a cameraman on a motorbike. And this was driving around Black Rock on overlapping routes. What was that about?
I think what we need to do is, without giving away my age or giving too much information, we have to consider that Eleanor was working on her PhD between 1991 and 1994.
Okay.
So we certainly weren't in the era of virtual reality. We had a small number of video games. You know, you might remember some of the early video games. But in order to look at something like real-world topographical memory or memory for location, we needed to come up with some method by which we could study it. And this is where Eleanor's genius, if you like, came to play at the very early stage. We wanted to make sure that rather than studying a patient's memory for tiny objects on a table in a room, we wanted to look at routes or navigation in the real world. So a friend of Eleanor's who was a cameraman volunteered his services and the services of a friend.
Yeah.
And we arranged to get videos made of two separate routes through Black Rock.
Brilliant.
But routes that overlapped, so they crossed over at a point on the route.
Okay.
And the idea then was that individuals who had undergone surgery would study each of the routes until they got to know all of the buildings, all of the landmarks on a route. And then they learned the second route. When we were certain that they knew these two routes, that they were fully familiar with them, Eleanor then waited for a period of time and then tested their memory for the information they had previously learned.
Incredible.
And in doing that, so the video was made at eye level as if you were walking along scanning the environment. So you were looking at buildings to both your left and your right, looking up and down side streets, etc. The kind of thing that VR technology can do quite easily now.
Yeah.
And Eleanor's results demonstrated for the first time in human subjects that whether the surgery was on the left or the right side of the brain, that individuals had difficulty recalling aspects of the spatial routes.
Okay, incredible. Incredible creativity. And you use the word genius.
Oh, without a doubt. I mean, Eleanor has, in a number of interviews over the years, talked about the fact that what inspired her to study spatial memory in particular, as opposed to, you know, my own PhD was on visual memory. Eleanor's was on spatial. She had read a summary of an article by two, you know, very famous people in neuropsychology. That's John O'Keefe and Lynn Nadell.
Okay.
And they had written a book in the late 1970s on the hippocampus as a cognitive map. Eleanor had read that was fascinated by their work. But she also noted, as an acute, or an astute rather, clinician, that patients who were undergoing the surgery in Beaumont at the time were spontaneously reporting that their spatial memory wasn't as good as it had been.
Ah.
So she put these two things together.
Yeah, yeah.
That is, the O'Keefe and Nadell work on the hippocampus and its role in spatial memory, particularly in animal species, and asked the question whether the same might be true in terms of humans. Eleanor was inspired by the work of O'Keefe and Nadell, but I think she herself would have been exceptionally chuffed by the fact that Lynn Nadell, one of the co-authors of that work that inspired her,
mm-hmm.
wrote in her memory on a memory wall created by her colleagues.
Yeah.
I'll just read from it if you don't mind.
Lynn said,
I first heard of Eleanor in 1994 from John O'Keefe, the other co-author, who told me about an outstanding student whose dissertation he had just read as the external examiner and how she was going to change the field.
Yeah.
So John, I had approached John O'Keefe to act as the external examiner for Eleanor's thesis, and he made it absolutely clear, even at her viva, that this would be world-changing in terms of the impact of her research.
That was Theresa Burke, retired professor of psychology at DCU, talking to Joe Duffy on Liveline today. Well, we haven't had much sunshine recently, but one surefire sign that spring has sprung is the arrival of frog spawn in our ponds and puddles. Donna Mullen, ecologist and author of Make Your Home a Nature Reserve, joined Claire Byrne to tell her it's all happening over the next few days.
So it is the next few days, is it, that all of this is going to kick off?
Yes, exactly. And it's already started in some of the warmer counties, but I live up near Bailieborough and there's nothing happening there yet. But soon the male frogs will go into little drainage ditches and small ponds and they'll start singing. And the singing is just irresistible. It's as if, George Clooney suddenly sent us a message to go meet him immediately. We just drop everything and run. And so...
Can we hear this?
So, yeah, we can. Yeah, we can. And the females hear it from about 50 metres away and they just run to the ponds where the frogs
are. Right, so it's instantly attractive for the females, the singing.
Absolutely.
And they all arrive together, do they?
They all arrive together and it's like, you'll just see, you have to be really careful. You know, usually it's when it's raining and they run across roads. And so you have to drive really carefully. If you see one frog, just slow down your car because there'll be loads more. You don't want to kill all the girls running to the singing. So when they get there, then it's just amazing. It's the singing, there's jumping around, and it's just for a couple of days. So I always say it's like a music festival. There's romance. There is
partying, dancing.
Yeah.
And is life normally like that for frogs? Like, is it an exciting life in general terms?
No, it's very boring. Normally, they just live in grass. Where they eat slugs and insects, which is really why it's great to have them in your garden. They'll eat all the slugs for you. They eat earthworms as well. Normally, it's a really boring life that they live. But it's like they cram all the excitement into this, 48 hours. And it definitely, like, it looks amazing. If there is reincarnation, I want to come back as a frog because this just looks incredible. So what happens is the females go to the little patch of water, and then the males jump on top of them to fertilize the eggs as they're laying them. Now the females are slippery, so the males have this little thing on their wrists called an nuptial pad, and it's like Velcro, and it sticks them to the back of the female.
To the slippy back of the female.
Yeah, the slippy back. So they have a thing like a little suction cup thing, because other than that, they just would slide off.
Mm-hmm.
Now, other males come along as well. And then there's wrestling goes on between, they're all trying to jump on the female.
OK, but if you have this male who's singing and all the females rush along, Is there another male who'll say, oh, that fella has attracted all those females, so I'm going to try and muscle in?
Yes, exactly. And then there can be a bit like the Bridget Jones Diary kind of thing. The two males are fighting and wrestling. And the female in all of this, it's really why anyone putting in a pond for frogs, it should be shallow. The female can end up getting drowned under all this, all the males all fighting over. And then there's the males, actually the Irish Herpetological Association call them the pirate males. And these, but I think they should be the pacifist males. They're the ones that look and say, I'm not going to fight here. This isn't worth the hassle. I could end up getting killed. So they steal the frog spawn. So they take the frog spawn and they fertilize
the passive male.
Yeah. So they call they're usually like frogs that are small,
okay,
and kind of a bit wimpy, and they haven't a chance of getting on top of the female.
But sneaky.
So they take the frog spawn and then they fertilize it. Now it'll mostly have been fertilized by the dominant male that's hanging on to the back of the female. But not all of it. And then so he has a chance of fertilising some of them.
Right. And the frog spawn, is that laid by the female in the same place where the party has happened?
Yes, exactly. And there'll be hundreds or thousands of frogs. You'll see them all, like it's just an enormous puddle of frogs.
Mm-hmm.
It's just absolutely amazing.
So what happens then? Do they all stay around while the frog spawn is there?
So yeah, after a while they move out. So it's about a month is when all the mating takes place. And in fact, if anybody sees it, because it's always interesting to know how many frogs we have and what's going on. The Irish Peatland Conservation Council have a survey, the Hop To It Frog Survey. And you can log, if you find frog spawn, log it with them so they know the numbers that are there. But the frogs then move back out, and basically the frog spawn has to fend for itself. It's insulated, and that's why it's in big clumps. So
In the jelly,
yeah. And then they can actually eat the jelly as well. But the insulation, because it's in the big clumps, it said it can raise the temperature up to about 10 degrees.
Mm.
So even if there's a bit of frost, the frog spawn will probably survive.
But there's nobody there to mind the tadpoles when they emerge.
No. And most of them get eaten or die. Or most, they say, you know, there's, you know, 2,000 to 4,000 eggs being laid by the frog, the female frog. But maybe 1% or 2% of them survive.
Okay.
Very few survive.
Now, we used to bring the frog. You're not allowed to do this anymore, so don't do it. But many, many years ago, we used to bring the frog spawn home to try and grow frogs. And successfully, they would emerge, much to the delight of my parents. They'd have the legs, the back legs and the front legs. Then they'd lose the tail and you have your own frog.
Yeah.
Very useful thing to have.
Yeah. And teachers are still allowed to collect frog spawn for the nature table under a derogation licence from the MPWS. But the rest of us aren't.
To leave it alone.
But actually, if you want to get your own frog spawn and frogs, the easy thing is to just put in a pond. Put in those little trays that go under your bed, you know, for keeping your shoes together, or the plastic trays for putting kids' toys in.
A plastic box?
A plastic box, yeah.
Like so dig it down into the garden.
And shallow, you know, not very deep.
Mm-hmm.
And shallow. And the frogs will just come to it. Now, if you have them in your garden, and the Peatland Conservation Society there, they found that garden ponds were a really important thing for preserving frogs. So, but if you're looking at your frogs and your tadpoles and they're starting to go white, it means that they're getting to be albino, and it means that there's inbreeding. So they need to meet other frogs. So you need to make a little frog pathway for them to get in and out of your garden.
How are our frog numbers in general? Because you do hear people saying, I saw a frog, and then somebody else will say, oh, that was just a toad.
Yeah.
Are we more likely to see frogs or toads?
Oh, we're more likely to see frogs. There's only one species of toad here, the Natterjack toad.
Mm-hmm.
And it's very, very rare. It's just in Kerry and it's in Waterville, it's in Dingle, and there's some in Wexford. But frogs can look very different. So you can have tiny little green ones, and the females are bigger. I had an enormous big brown one sitting out on my in my front garden, and you just can't believe they're all the same species. But the way you know they're frogs rather than toads, you know, Amy Winehouse used to have that black eyeshadow round her eyes,
yeah,
and going back to her. Frogs have that. So they have, like a eyeliner. Black patch, like eyeliner. And they have black bars on their legs as well.
And the toads are more like Pamela Anderson, no makeup.
No makeup. And they're also a little warty.
Okay.
So they're, but you're very lucky if you have toads.
I love the analogy, Claire. That's ecologist and author Donna Mullen on Today with Claire Byrne. And finally, comedian Jason Byrne was Oliver Callan's guest this morning. He was in to chat about his life, career and his heart condition.
Yeah, so I had five stents, but I got one put in again just after, maybe 6 months after, for the crack. So that was quite funny.
That's number six, was it?
Yeah, they do that. They do. There's a thing called an invasive angiogram. I love saying stuff like this because I sound like a doctor. People who have had operations, they use all the big words because they only know the big words.
That's
because
all they've been constantly hearing for.
Yeah. So I've had an invasive angiogram, which I've never heard of in my life, but that's what I had, where they go into your wrist and into your heart. And so it was just after the five, there was a bit, I just felt a bit weird. Nothing. It was fine. And then he just said, oh, look, I think it might be just a bit of a bend in the artery there where the other stents are. It could have just caused a little bit. He said, it's not a problem. And then he said, I mean, it's mad as a doctor. And I love the surgeons and all. And he said, oh, sure, while I'm in here, I might as well put another stent in. So he's going, ah, yeah, go on.
Like while you're open.
Yeah, it's like you're at the bar. Ah, sure, I'm here, I might as well get you. Do you want another one? So he threw us another one in. No, you're not open, by the way.
I was wondering, I was going to ask you, are they small? They're small incisions, aren't they?
Yeah, so I did, right, so got the... It goes into, it's a top, well, it only goes into your wrist. And if you're a bit older, they'll go into your leg. They won't open up your heart fully unless you're doing open heart surgery, obviously, right? And here's me doing the doctor thing again. But here's the mad one.
Don't take Jason Byrne's advice on any of this.
No, don't. I just know what happened to me, right? And so I went, I got a call then from Clonmel. Oh my God, I can't recall the, so the people who make the stents, anyway, are in Clonmel.
Oh, are they?
Yeah, I thought all the catheter.
The stents in the world are 80% of stents in the world are made in Ireland, well, Galway, and maybe it's Clonmel as well.
But you're,
I will bow to your greater knowledge.
No. But you're going to have all the knowledge because you're sitting here in front of it all the time. You have a full team. Because people at home don't know this. Oliver says something really slowly while his team types it.
Yeah, that's right.
And then the fact is true or false at the end, where Oliver goes, and that's what happened. Yes, that's definitely Oliver.
But they've ruined it by putting cameras in studios now. They can see. Oh, yeah, I'm just reading the information. Sorry. So stents. Is it like a straw that bypasses an artery, or is it inside the artery? Do you know this detail?
All I know. Yeah, I know it's a catheter that goes into your wrist, into the artery, but it goes into your heart so fast. That was the fright. Do you know what I mean? They're lying there and he just goes in with the, you know, with his little tube, and he just goes, oh, we're in there now. I mean, from your arm to your heart, it just goes like that. It's fast. And then he puts a tiny little stent.
As in the stent stays in the wrist, does it?
Yeah, no, it's got to get in there somehow. No, the stent
doesn't shoot to your heart.
No. Yes, it does.
Does it? Okay. This
no,
is
no,
news
no.
To me.
He doesn't send the stent off and goes, best of luck now. And then teach like a dog and goes, go left, go right. No, he moves it all the way in with it like a tube.
Oh, God.
It goes all the way in. And then he puts it into your artery. But the thing goes in first, the balloon opens it, and then the stent follows behind.
Oh, yeah.
And then it's like corrugated, that's corrugated iron. You know, it opens and closes, like kind of pushes open. Constantinus, I'm trying to think of that word, whatever.
Yeah.
Opens up, and then he takes it back out, and that stays open, and it opens your artery.
And you've had that done six of them?
Six of them, but that's nothing. That
Are
was
you
like,
awake during this procedure?
Yeah. I mean, but I was awake because and look, the Irish people were, and listening to everybody, always ask your doctor everything, right? Because Irish people, they're like, oh, yeah, I'll be all right, I suppose it'd be grand. Like, do you want any, they call it fizzy juice. And a lot of Irish people will go, no, I'm all right, because they're too embarrassed. I was going, load me up. So they loaded me up with that. But it's only after Oliver, right, that with Steph Professor, or Dr. I don't know what he I was, okay, anyway, he's brilliant, Niall Mulvihill. And, afterwards, he was just checking me in the bed and all. He goes, how are you? He goes, yeah, grand. And I come off the fizzy juice and I said, oh, my God, that was mad being awake. He says, do I have to be awake? Do I have to be awake for that? Because I never asked him. And he went, nah, I could have put you asleep. I went, what? He goes, yeah, but it means such...
Old time.
He goes, but then we'll have to give you a full anaesthetic and all the fuss. He goes, you're fine awake. And you are. You're fine away because they're just talking away to you.
You don't chat. Do you chat back when they're...
Yeah, you chat back. Yeah. He's going, that's going in there now. When the first 10 went in, they all gave each other high fives. That was brilliant. They went, wow, look at that. Good stent. They all said good stent. And they were going, and even I was going, yeah, that's a good one. Here, let's do another one.
If they don't say that when the rest of them are going in, do you start to get worried?
No, it's okay. You're fine. No, you don't have to get too worried. It was good. So they all went, I don't know, an hour. I was in there for an hour. Open, like, into your heart surgery. But it's just, I got a high cholesterol, by the way, in case anybody was wondering. I had it from my mum and dad. Thanks, mum and dad.
So your health was very good and your diet was excellent. So
it wasn't excellent, but it wasn't bad. It was just, I make too much cholesterol. So they had to...
How did you know what you needed them to? Were you doing regular blood tests every year?
No, I was just, well, first of all, I went for, I was just going for a run. And I had a little pressure on my heart. Not on my heart, but somewhere just at the side.
In the chest, left side of the chest.
Yeah, so you'll feel little bits of pressure. You don't really feel pain. You feel pressure. I think the pain is when it runs down your arm. Because just to show about the pain, I went back to my doctor, my heart surgeon, whatever, after. And I said, I can feel where the stents all went in. And he was writing down a bit of paper and he went, that's brilliant. He goes, what, that's a miracle?
That's not possible.
He goes, why? Well, there's no nerve endings in there. Right. So well done. Congratulations, you're the first human. But to say that, and this is good news for everybody listening, is you should listen to your own body. Because I was, before they put the stents in, Niall said to his team, he said, watch this. He said, Jason, can you point to me where you think the stents need to go? And I was more or less bang on with my fingers, which I shouldn't be able to do.
Oh, really?
Because you don't...
No nerve ending there.
Well, no, but that's how much...
You should know, exactly where your heart is.
Yeah, I know where my heart is, but like, oh yeah, it wasn't... Yeah, I'm sure it wasn't bang on. They're going, well done, Jason. Left side.
Did you have to change much about your lifestyle since?
No, I just more checkups. So that's the good thing. The doctor, Rory Hanlon, just said, look, now we're going to be able to just keep an eye on you. So that's it.
So you're the best-minded heart in the country now at this stage.
Yeah. Well, anybody who has a heart problem, it just gets monitored all the time. Yes. You're fine. The best thing to do is, though, and here's the usual, isn't it? Just go and get checked. You're grand. Because here's the one the doctor said to me. If you come early enough, I can change your diet, right? If you come later again, I'm going to put you on pills. If you come later again, you're going to need stents. If you come later again, I'm going to need to open you up.
All right.
So the earlier, the better. Just go in. So I don't know, even if you're in your 30s or whatever, just go on in and check your...
It's a good idea to listen to your body, because when you come into middle age, you just expect twinges and groans. You go, that's just 40 plus.
Yeah, I know. It's a doctor...
Ignore that.
Yeah, you can go in and you have like a pain or a problem and they just go, yeah, it's because you're 53. And you go, yeah, but can you fix the thing? No. No, it's just that's where it's...
No cure for that.
It's gone. It's like it's a certain part of the body which I won't mention fully on air, but people can guess, which is basically used like a pedal bin all your life for 53 years. And people listening in will know they've got to go to doctors quite a lot for that area.
It needs to be looked after.
Yeah.
When we have a comedian in you, I always look up the YouTube things.
It's very
I always
good.
Click on the most viewed videos, and it threw up some mad things for you.
Yeah,
usually it's in one subject, but for you, there's 60 seconds of you doing nipple twisting, wearing only underwear at the BBC. Doing the Irish magic tricks. Of course, people would have seen this with your shows. In Melbourne.
Well, I did the Melbourne Comedy Gala, and I did a stunt once, and then that was it. They just said, because I wanted to do stand up again. They're going, no, can you do the stunt again? Can you do it again? It's gone. So every year I had to come up with
that go horribly wrong.
They were like, yeah, because I was a fan of Tommy Cooper. I could have sold those to Tommy Cooper, which would have been brilliant.
That's right.
So Tommy Cooper I loved, and I just did silly magic tricks, which were like, but then they were like, you know, I did them a lot on stage to try and work out how to do them really silly. But then got complaints from magicians, which was brilliant, on YouTube. Going, these are disgraceful, these tricks. You're a disgrace to the magic circle. It's going, what? I had a fella in a box twisted to a pair of runners. You know, so so I love doing that.
Loads of Ireland's Got Talent clips, which is the thing I forget. You've done so many things. And then you're on the Graham Norton show with Geoffrey Rush, because obviously you're obsessed with Australians, and Gwyneth Paltrow.
Yeah.
Do you remember that night?
Yeah, I do. Oh, my God. Well, Gwyneth Paltrow was doing a cookbook or something. Okay, I remember the backstage bit, which was bizarre. So the backstage, you stand, obviously, it's behind the set. So where you walk through, just before you see Graham, is just a bit of tat behind you. Nothing
nice back there.
No, and there's wires and stuff. And Gwyneth Paltrow's on one side of me and Jeffrey Rush's the other side. And Jeffrey, Lady Gaga was on for the first time.
Oh, wow.
Right? And she was going to be on three songs. It was a famous time. She was wearing like a Lady Madonna type of top that was designed by an Irish designer.
Oh,
that
yes.
Clothes, right? Okay. But that was when she was in her kind of odd phase, you know, very surreal, and she's very, very normal now.
Yeah. You know what I mean? She's going back to that, actually.
Oh, is she going back to it again? Yeah. Oh, God, I can't keep up. Anyway, so Jeffrey Rush is one side, Gwyneth Paltrow is just like Jason in the middle. In your head, you go, what am I doing here? And Gwyneth Paltrow looks at the both of us and goes, oh, my God, Lady Gaga's on. Like that, and going, yeah. And she goes, he's never going to talk to us. We're going to have no airtime at all.
That's what she's thinking.
And then we went out and she oh my God, Gwyneth Paltrow had paella under the seats. What? Under the seats where we had paella, to go out and taste it.
Oh, so she brought her food with her.
Yeah,
she?
But it was under the seats.
God.
And me and Jeffrey.
Did you have to taste it?
You have to say it's nice. But it was freezing and whatever.
Oh my God, cold rice.
We're like, oh, very nice. And Graham was just looking at us laughing because he wasn't tasting it. It's too far away. Good, too far away, was it, Graham? Too far away.
I love the insecurity of the megastar sitting in the wings. It's like, I'm the big star. Oh, wait, no, Gaga's here. That's
yeah, it. I know. And then she was right because Lady Gaga sang like two songs, maybe three, I can't remember. So, yeah, we got very little airtime. But Jeffrey Rush was lovely to me.
Was he?
Yeah, because he was the ambassador of the arts of Melbourne when I was on that show. And he goes, Jason's great. We love Jason. We love him.
Yes.
You know?
Good to have a supporter.
And, yeah, and he goes, he's just, because he's talking about the magic trick. He watched me do all that stuff. And then name check Tommy Cooper, which was brilliant.
Wow.
But he's a lovely man. And I said to him, are you, because he was supposed to be at the Pirates of the Caribbean premiere that night. I said, you're not supposed to be there now. And he goes, my dear, he says, I've never seen myself on screen. I said, what? I make the movies and I leave. And I said, but what about the premiere? He goes, we don't sit in there. I says, I thought they're all in there with their popcorn. He says, they go down the middle, wave, go out the door and go back and off. They go.
They're gone.
Don't open
they never watch the film.
But I think in Cannes they must. But not in London. It's just like
you would in Cannes, wouldn't you?
You have to, don't you? Because don't they stand up for ages?
They do, yeah. The standing ovations, or you get abused. They shout and boo at you.
Do they?
Yes.
Yeah, have you been
Cannes
there?
Way. No, I've just read the reports. Oh. Just like I read the reports about you. Did you live in Melbourne or something for a while, or did you just want to live there?
Oh, yeah. Well, I'm kind of glad I didn't, because like I was 15, 16 years back and forth to Melbourne and Perth, and I know the whole of Australia, like, but mainly Melbourne. But they're not, you know, the Irish go there and they think they're like us, but they're not. They're not like us at all.
Really?
So the Irish go there and eventually end up as with other Irish people. They don't drink heavily, like, and they don't socialise like that either. They are outside all the time. They drink smoothies. They run everywhere. They cycle everywhere. They love their rules, which is a big problem for Irish people. They love their rules.
Yeah. It's a sophisticated kind of European feeling city, I think, Melbourne, is it, compared to Sydney?
Well, I got in trouble with them. I says, you don't know who yous are, do you? They don't know who they are. Because they think they're American, but then they're not. Then they're Australian. Because they live like Californians.
Comedian Jason Byrne chatting to Oliver Callan this morning. And that's all we have time for on this edition of Playback Daily. So from me, Louise Herity, thanks for listening and take care.